Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause in keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the Donate tab. Good morning, everyone. It's really great to be here this morning. I haven't been to the morning group since it started about a year and a half ago. I'm very grateful for Mikey and Rachel, our longtime community members and facilitators at Wild Heart, that they've been holding it down. It's good to see people showing up in the room and just taking this time to spend their Sunday morning practicing meditation together and talking about what's in their hearts. It's really a special thing. This community has been a refuge for me. It's been a place where I feel like I can be real with myself. And that's the thing about meditation, is that when you sit down, you come into contact with whatever's in the mind and the body in that moment. We don't get to really pick that. So I was just noticing as I was sitting, some anxiety coming up. I've just been trying to kind of lead with that. These past couple times I've been teaching, is to try to just lead with what's in my heart. Because my anxiety tells me to not share that it's there. But that's precisely the opposite of what we're trying to do here. At least what I'm trying to do here. Trying to be with, whatever is coming up in the heart, in the mind, in the moment. So I've been thinking about this idea. We're going to give a Dharma talk together. And if you're new, the Dharma is sometimes described as what we would just refer to as the Buddha's teachings. So the Buddha taught what we could call the Dharma. What the Dharma really means when translated is it means the way things are. I think maybe in our kind of Western culture we might hear that and think to ourselves, okay, the Buddha had some special mystical teaching that we're so fortunate to be able to hear and to discover. But really what the Buddha taught is he taught the way things are for all of us. That we have a heart, we have a mind that's affected by the world. And that we have a heart and a mind that struggles. And that we can find more relief and more freedom from the struggle in our heart and our mind. And so he taught a Dharma that is self-evident, one that we can experience ourselves, that we already have experienced. We've all had many moments of awakening, whether we're Buddhist or not. We've all had moments where we've woken up and seen the struggle in our lives, where we've, seen how we participate in some of the suffering and stress in our lives, and we've been able to make changes and transform ourselves. So one of the ways that we're instructed to teach the Dharma is, really in Zen Buddhism, they actually talk about this a lot, is not to teach about Buddhism, but to teach through transmission. And again, this isn't a special transmission. It's just transmitting, what our own experience has been with this path and this practice and, what it's done in our lives. And this morning, I want to talk a little bit about the Four Noble Truths, which are really the essence of the core teaching that the Buddha offered. And these truths aren't capital T truths. They're not dogmas. They're really reflections. They're contemplations. Buddhism's a contemplative practice. So we're being invited by the Buddha to this word ehipasika, to see for ourselves. I was talking to a friend yesterday about his life transition, and him and I were really connecting a lot. And I noticed as we were talking, the more vulnerable he got about his regrets and the areas of pain in his life, the more open I felt and the more willing I was to share about my regrets and the pain in my life. And there's almost this like kind of The more vulnerable he was, the more vulnerable I was willing to be. That's transmission. I just call it connection, really. And so the Buddha, in the mythological story of his awakening, he connected with some truths about human existence that are self-evident, that he saw for himself, that he connected within his own heart. And after the Buddha's awakening, he struggled to decide whether he was going to teach or try to talk to people about his experience. It's kind of like, I know we got a lot of recovery people in here. If you've ever taken acid or mushrooms, try to talk to someone about what that's like. Maybe a more secular kind of example is like you have a weird dream, right? It's like, how do you speak to something that's hard to articulate, right? I think the Dharma is a little bit psychedelic, but it's not created through substance. It's created through the essence of what it means to be human, through awareness, presence. And so the Buddha kind of struggled. He is like, well, how am I going to teach this? It's so against the stream, as he said, of greed and hatred and delusion, to turn towards our pain and suffering, to sit with our hearts and our mind, no matter what's coming up in them. He said, that's such a hard thing to do. But he thought about some friends that he was meditating with before his awakening and practicing these kind of ascetic, these austere, like, self-mortification practices. And he thought to himself that they had a connection and that they had enough mindfulness or awareness or understanding or interest in spirituality that he could probably talk to them and maybe they would get it. And so he made this long trek to go connect with his friends, and he delivered this discourse. It's the first teaching he ever offered. It's called Dhammacakka Papattana Sutta, the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the turning of the wheel of the Dharma. And I'm going to read it, and it's okay if you don't understand all the language right now, because we're going to kind of go into it. A couple things to start. The Buddha addresses these five friends as bhikkhus. And what bhikkhu means is it means someone that's interested in the spiritual life. So that's me and you, it's all of us in this room. He also uses this word dukkha, which I'm not going to translate because we'll talk about what it is later. I'm not going to translate in the passage, but it means something like stress, difficulty, friction. The sutta reads, "This is what I heard. The teacher was staying at Varanasi in the Deer Park at Isipatana. Then he addressed the group of five bhikkhus. There are, bhikkhus, two dead ends which should not be pursued by one who has gone forth," meaning one who is going after the spiritual life. "What are these two dead ends? Addiction to pleasure through indulging in sensuality, which is low, village-like, pertaining to the unawake person, undignified and unfulfilling. And the second, addiction to self-punishment, which is painful, undignified, and unfulfilling. The middle way, bhikkhus, awakened to by the Tathagata," which he's referring to himself, "does not lead to these two dead ends, but makes for vision and knowledge, is conducive to calming, lucid understanding, awakening, and nibbana." And what, bhikkhus, is this middle way? It is just this noble eightfold path, that is, wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. And then he goes on, and here's where he's teaching the Four Noble Truths. He says, this is dukkha, first noble truth. Birth is dukkha. Aging is dukkha. Sickness is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Encountering what is not dear to you is dukkha. Separation from what is dear to you is dukkha. Not getting what one wants is dukkha. This is the arising. This is the second noble truth. It is craving, which is repetitive, wallowing in attachment and greed, obsessively indulging in this and that. Craving for stimulation, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence. This is the ceasing, the traceless fading away and cessation of that craving, the third noble truth. The letting go and abandoning of it. Freedom and independence from craving. And this is the path with eight branches. Wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. Such is dukkha. It can be fully known. It has been fully known. Such is the arising of craving. It can be let go of. It has been let go of. Such is the ceasing of craving. It can be experienced. It has been experienced. Such is the path. It can be cultivated. It has been cultivated. I think it was said when he delivered this sutta that five people right there woke up, complete enlightenment. So maybe some of us are that lucky this morning. Not quite there yet, I don't think. So the first noble truth is the truth of dukkha. What is dukkha? And what is the truth of dukkha? So the importance here is that dukkha is not so much a truth as in this capital T thing to believe in, but it's rather something to be practiced as a contemplation and as an understanding, as a meditation, which Mikey is going to talk about later, how we practice that. So the first task, really, or practice that the Buddha is encouraging us to contemplate is to fully know dukkha. That's the task. Dukkha has an interesting etymology or origin. It means something like big empty or separate from the other. And it's related to a term that would be used to describe when an axle of like an ox cart doesn't quite fit well with the wheel well. So there's this kind of disjointedness in the wheel where the axle meets the wheel. And he's saying that this human condition, if we look at it, if we turn towards it, we'll see that there's stress, there's friction. Right? So if that's your experience, he's saying, I feel like the Buddha's trying to validate. He's not saying life is suffering. He's saying that, have you noticed, do you notice if you look at your life that it feels stressful sometimes? He says, have you noticed that there's birth, but by birth that means that you age and that you grow sick and that you will die, that you'll be separated from what's dear to you? He says, do you notice that sometimes you get what you want and sometimes you don't get what you want? He says, do you notice that life is stressful? Right? Dukkha is the modern day getting the shopping cart with the sticky wheel at the grocery store. You know, you can still drive the cart. It's not like we're completely screwed, but it just kind of sucks, right? It's just kind of annoying, and sometimes it's big time sucks. You get stuck in aisle 8 and it just stops working. So there are three flavors of dukkha, really, that we're turning towards and contemplating and reflecting on. The first is what the Buddha calls dukkha dukkha. This is the shitty, shitty dukkha. Dukkha dukkha is the inevitable, the inarguables, as some of my favorite teachers refer to them as, the inarguables of birth, aging, sickness, and death. A teacher that I really like and respect named Sayadaw Utejaniya. He'll ask his students sometimes, is Buddhism a optimistic religion or pessimistic religion? And they know what's coming, so no one answers because they know he wants to answer his own question. And he'll laugh and slap his leg. He'll say, it's a realistic religion. This is what's real, right? Birth, aging, sickness, death. That's what's real. And not even in a special way, but in a very ordinary way. Something that we all will experience. on the physical level, the body is a realm of discomfort. That's what it is. I'm sure many of us, myself included, even in this moment, could feel into the body and observe dukkha, physical discomfort. I have a chronic pain that flares up from time to time in my back, and it's just this kind of constant throbbing feeling. It's always there. We get sick, we become injured. We may have even been born with challenging physical limitations. We may have terminal illnesses. We naturally experience grief, lamentation, and despair. Right? So this is the objective reality of birth, aging, sickness, and death. And what the Buddha is saying is that we don't ever get the ability in this lifetime to escape those things, dukkha, dukkha. But what he does say is that we can escape the denial and resistance of those realities that in turn causes suffering. When we deny, when we resist, when we argue with what's inarguable, we suffer. But when we're awake to the reality of our birth, aging, sickness, death, we live life from a wakeful place, a place of non-denial and non-resistance, a place of meaning. Right? There's this sense of, I talked about in my group last week, samvega, or the spiritual urgency of what is important. What is important? Not in a morbid, anxious way, but in a very real, grounded way. What's important? Right? So that's why we want to fully know dukkha. So we want to be able to know how things are so we don't fight, argue, resist, or turn into denial around these truths. Second type of dukkha the Buddha talked about is sankhara dukkha, which is the mental obsession and suffering that comes when things don't quite measure up to how we want them to be. So this is the kind of obsession about trying to fix, manage, and control the environment, the world, constantly to be to our liking, to be pleasant and comfortable. And so here's the tricky thing. We're going to talk about this because these bridge, all these noble truths, they intertwine. But the Buddha's not saying that comfort is bad. He's saying that when we are constantly caught up in the stress of trying to feel good, right, and we resist the reality of feeling uncomfortable or being in whatever experience we're in, we suffer. Right? I like to call these, sometimes these are the self-made stories of our mind. It's the mind stories about taking our conditions in our life personally. Like the comparing mind. I'm doing great. I'm kicking ass. Everyone else in here doesn't know what the hell they're talking about, right? I got my shit together. I'm good to go, right? There's this kind of better than type of suffering. That one's tricky to see because the mind really likes ego inflation. It likes to feel good about itself. But you'll notice on the same day sometimes, maybe in the same hour, something else happens and then you're the worst piece of shit in the world. It's like, man, I'm totally lost. I'm alone. I'm a loser. I work at this, you know, job. I don't have a partner. The mind will just list all of the things that I don't have. This is sankhara dukkha, mental obsession, self-obsession. I'm good. I'm bad. Largely dependent upon how I feel in the moment, right? So if I feel good, I'm doing good. If I feel bad, I'm doing bad. And then the last is viparinama dukkha, which is the anxiety of trying to hold on to things that are constantly changing, holding on to pleasant experiences. I call this Sunday dukkha, right? Holding on to the weekend. You know, it's like I gotta keep this thing going. It's a nice day. It's about to rain for a week, right? Gotta do all the things. And so we're so filled with anxiety trying to hold on to the experience that we miss it. It's like, oh, actually, in this moment, we're here. Have you noticed your mind? You don't have to say so, but I bet many of us have. Thinking about what you're going to do after this yet? Not our fault. It's just what the mind does. So this is the second noble truth, which is, because of life's insecurity, unpredictability, the change, the constant flow and transient nature of life, our real ultimate lack of control. Because of that, reactivity arises. We don't want to feel insecure. We don't want the body to age, to get old, to get sick. We do want Sunday to last. We do want to feel good and to always feel good. It's not our fault, right? But because life is constantly in flux and changing, we try to fashion it and control it to how we want. And this is what the Buddha calls tanha and upadana, thirst and clinging. Craving is the translation, or reactivity, really. I like that word, reactivity. That's our kind of secular science word that I think our Western culture really relates to. Secular mindfulness talks a lot about reactivity. But what the Buddha was talking about is tanha, and tanha is this thirst. I like that word because it's a longing, right? It's the fever of unsatisfied longing, an incessant wanting. Right, I like the word thirst because there's this kind of visceral sense. I know what it's like to be thirsty. And we even have a pop culture word for being thirsty. Someone that's being like, you know, really, I don't know, how would you describe that? What's thirsty
needy.
Like? Needy. So this thirst is this kind of longing, this feverish longing for satisfaction. Upadana is clinging. It's the trying to hold on to control. And he's saying that the real reason that we suffer, that inherent in life is dukkha, that there's this stressful kind of quality of life, but the reason why we really suffer is because we argue with that and we try to fix, change, and control things to our liking. We long for things to be comfortable when they're uncomfortable. But there's a difference between desire and craving. Desire is a sense of, you know, being able to rest in the discomfort and maybe skillfully move towards some comfort or some ease and well-being. This is why the Buddhist path is called the middle path, right? Is that it's a practice to learn the difference within ourselves in the moment. And Mikey will talk about this rain meditation that helps us to do this. It frees up the space to understand when we're craving and when we're caught up in obsession and, when we're in obsession and craving, and when we're able to actually relax a little bit and move with more of an ability to respond. Desire is important, right? We have to have desire to even develop our spiritual path. The Buddha calls this chanda. Chanda is a wholesome motivation. It's wanting to do something. It's like having a goal or an aspiration. But craving is this neediness. I'll actually read this quote by Ajahn Sucitto. He does a great job describing the difference. He says that craving is the type of desire that's never satisfied because it just shifts from one emotional need to the next, from one sense of achievement to another goal. It's the desire that comes from a black hole of need, however small and manageable that need is. So what is the task with the second noble truth? It is to be aware of the arising of this reactivity, of this craving, this kind of control and mental obsession, and to learn to let ourselves relax around that and let go of feeding the craving. To let go of, the Buddha calls it perpetual wandering, running around in our craving. This is what's called samsara, is the cycle of being reborn. And maybe over the course of lifetimes, quite possibly, we don't know. But being reborn into the same patterns of repetitive craving over and over again. So craving doesn't have to be intense. It can be, something subtle. It can be like anticipation, Like that feeling you get in your body when you're sitting here and you think about what you want to do next. There's just that kind of subtle restlessness and anticipation that comes up. Here's the important thing the Buddha's not doing. He's not judging or saying we're bad because we have craving. He's not actually saying the craving should go away. He's saying the craving should be let go of. Let it happen. Let it be. I like the word let it be or the phrase let it be much more than let it go. Because let it go has the sense of I need to get rid of the craving. Not true. He says craving is repetitive. You don't get rid of it. It keeps coming. Right? But it's the ceasing. It's the letting go of getting caught or stuck in the habit. It's letting the feeling arise without feeding the feeling. That means in the moment when you're sitting here and your mind jumps into the, what am I going to do next? There's an opportunity to just tell the mind gently without judgment, I see you, mind. Right? Not right now. And then you come back and there's still that restless feeling in the body and you breathe and you relax and you remind yourself, like Mikey said at the beginning, that you're here. You remind yourself with your breath. Right? And then you experience this third noble truth, which is the ceasing of the reactivity, the fading away of craving and clinging. The Buddha says, by not reviving the past, by not hoping to be in the future, instead, with insight, in this moment, you see each arising state. Not craving after the past experience, not setting one's heart on future, not bound up in craving. With insight, we see each arising state. We see the craving in the mind with mindfulness. Melvin Connor is a neuroscientist. He said that the internal state of the human nervous system can be best categorized as a vague mixture of anxiety and desire. He said, best described by the phrase, I want, spoken with or without an object for the verb. Not our fault. You are born into a nervous system that wants comfort. But we can notice it, and we don't have to satisfy every longing, every desire that the mind has. We can actually intervene in a kind way, by just noticing, as the Buddha says, with insight, seeing each arising state, not reviving the past, not hoping to be in the future, with insight, seeing each arising state. I like to talk about the third noble truth is this awakening, this practice of developing a responsibility. I'm not in fault for my mind, but I'm responsible for it. I'm not at fault for the craving and reactivity that arises in my mind, but I am responsible. I love the word responsible because it not only means that I am accountable to it when it arises, but I'm actually developing through mindfulness an ability to respond, to watch the craving that says to argue or to compare or to dip out of the meditation center to go get some ice cream. To watch that and to be able to have the ability to respond and be like, hey, mind, I see you, I care about you, thank you, but not right now. It's an ability to respond. It's a really powerful thing. Someone says, I think it's some Zen or Tibetan master says that the mind makes a great servant, but a horrible master. We want the mind. The mind, we can't stop thoughts, unfortunately. It's like a roommate we're stuck with for the rest of our lives, but we don't have to... We don't have to listen to everything that says. We don't have to take the mind so personally. Or we can step back and have a relationship. And this is what the awakening is. It's literally waking up. Waking up. Seeing clearly and responding wisely. Having a relationship. Awakening is gradual. The Buddha says that just as the ocean gradually shelves, slopes, and inclines, there's no sudden precipice. So also in this Dharma, there is a gradual training. He says a gradual course, a gradual progression. There's no sudden penetration to final knowledge. We're not trying to get anywhere through meditating. We're just trying to be aware. We're trying to get here with awareness. We're trying to get here over and over again. If you're ever wondering where your practice should lead you, it's here every time. So when I was sitting at the beginning, I noticed the anxiety. My anxiety told me I should be some other way. shouldn't be anxious. I should be confident, competent. I'm supposed to teach this stuff. I should know better than to have anxiety. Right? It sounds ridiculous when you say it, but that's the implicit message that my mind tells me when I'm anxious. Fortunately, in this moment, I was able to recognize and see with insight, as the Buddha said, this arising state and say, oh, okay, here's a longing, a reactivity, a wanting for things to be different than the way that they are. Where should my practice lead me? Here. This is where I am with my anxiety. Then there's this responsibility, an ability to respond, and an ability to actually have the responsibility to share the human condition. So how do we develop this? We develop this through the fourth noble truth, which is the cultivation of the Eightfold Path. As the Buddha says, wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. I like the word wise. It's translated as word sama, which sometimes they used to translate as right view, right intention. Right and wrong is hard for the Western mind. It's not so much that way in Southeast Asia. You tell someone to do something right, they don't have as much shame and moral judgment around doing it wrong. They don't take it as personally, right? But we kind of have that need to be right. So sama actually means something like complete view, right? Or a wide, broad view. Complete intention, a wise intention. And so it's more of this kind of holistic path. The middle path is a path of balance. Right? We're never quite in the middle of the path. We go a little too far left and we say, all right, go right. You go a little too far right, you go left. That's spiritual practice, right? It's back and forth. But we can always find these four noble truths here. They're available to us. The Buddha says that the Dharma is immediate and visible. He says, sensed by the wise. It's immediate and visible. But he also says it's subtle and hard to see. And therein lies the paradox of this practice. Mindfulness, easiest shit in the world. I can't believe I get paid to teach it sometimes at treatment center. I'm like, I'm basically just telling people to sit here, focus on their breath, watch their mind. All right, cool. Give me money. Hard to do, right? Subtle, you know, difficult to see sometimes. So anyway, this is offered for your reflection. Mikey's going to talk a little bit about this other piece, and we're going to do some meditation together.
You know, sometimes we get together and we reflect on what our job is here as teachers, and something he said, I think it's you said, that we're here to motivate. So this is a talk with a lot of words and a lot of concepts and a lot of ideas, and this is hopefully motivating you to do something. And so this Dharma is something we experience directly. Sometimes I'll give the instructions that the truth of the whole universe exists in the process of in and out breathing. And so when we commit to be in harmony with, like, sama. I recently heard that word, sama, as in like right view, right intention in the Eightfold Path that he was talking about. Sama, I've heard it recently translated as a musical term. Like, sa is a musical term in Pali. And so to put this in harmony with what is, this disjointedness, can we put it in harmony with what is? And so, are we in harmony with the truth of the universe? When we watch the arising and passing of the breath, we get informed of the rising and passing of all conditions and how that brings some letdown from time to time in life and the impersonal nature of this in and out breath. I heard a teacher recently say that if you think there's a separate self, hold your nose and hold your mouth and see how that's working out for you. And so how do we become in harmony? How do we put this to practice? a lot of concepts and a lot of ideas, but we want to embody and know and live this out. And so the topic, the comparing this sacred and secular, that I don't know if there's really much difference, but it's nice to put this in modern language so we can have it in a way that we can apply it. This very ordinary practice, extremely ordinary practice. They call it the super mundane. Going back to the ordinary. It's nice to have the motivation and faith and know at the end of this tunnel is some sort of awakening, some sort of relief, some sort of, dare I say, bliss. And right now, it's like this. Some of you may know this quote, Viktor Frankl. Between stimulus and response, there is space. In that space is our power to choose a response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. So without clear seeing, we're just obedient to the impulses. There is no free will without mindfulness. If we don't see what directly is in front of us, whether it's the dukkha, dukkha, sankhara, dukkha, viparinama, dukkha, we don't know dukkha directly, we're going to be swept away with it from the craving and the reactivity. We live in these very reactive bodies. And so we develop these coping strategies to fix, manage, push out, control the suffering in our lives. And then we incline our human systems to be these machines that are constantly in flux of manipulation, trying to find a comfortable place to land. Wonderful talk he called BS on that. There is no necessarily comfortable place to land. It's going to be fluctuating. And so therefore, we want to set a momentum to meet this experience with peacefulness and care and gentleness, because it's going to change. There's a Mahayana story called The Flower Sermon. And it's a story about the Buddha. He's well established and he held up a flower. And he did this for hours, just held a flower. People are expecting this beautiful talk and this transmission of Dharma through words. But he just held up this flower. So what I think happens in this story is people were confused. People had ideas. They're thinking, oh, I knew the Buddha was full of shit. He's a crazy guy holding up the flower. Or maybe they're thinking, oh, I'm full of shit. I don't get this. This guy's holding this flower. It's really wacky. But there's one person there that didn't have any of these projections. He was actually with the moment of the Buddha holding the flower, and he smiled. And the Buddha smiled back, and this was the transmission that happened. He was able to be with something very simple, just the Buddha holding a flower. And how do we get that? We learn to know to be with the difficulties in life. Because as soon as we develop these mental strategies to avoid the suffering in life, that becomes a habit, and so therefore we miss the nice things in life. So we can't selectively numb. So what we want to do in a very reasonable way, and we take our time with this. I'm not trying to throw anybody off the deep end to dive into their deepest traumas. I want to set a inclination to meet suffering, pain, confusion with a little bit of care at a time. Sometimes we get really ambitious with this and we can just shut our systems down, you know? Like, I'm going to meet my deepest trauma, and then we just have a traumatic response in meditation and we're just shut down. So we want to do this carefully and slowly. And so the acronym RAIN is what I'm focusing on. It was initially a Dharma teacher, Michelle McDonald, was the one who came up with this. So this has been around for like 20 years. It's been a long time coming. And Tara Brach has kind of lifted this up to add an extra flavor of gentleness and care. And so this acronym RAIN may have a couple different letters to it. I'll let you know. So R is recognize. You recognize what is happening. A is allow. I is investigate. I'd also like to have I as being a flavor of intimacy, too. So there are a couple I's in there. Investigate with an intimacy. You want to be intimate with this suffering. And then N, we have a non-identifying. Or I like nurture, too. So when we come to a place of this is simple and profound, this is both of these things. When we come to the simple of recognizing I'm in a stressful spot right now. We meet it directly and we allow the stress to be here. We care for the stress. Okay, stress. We say yes to this. We're so inclined to say no to stress. We're so inclined to say no to anxiety, to sadness, to grief, to all of this. We find a place to go, oh, right now I'm feeling sad. Allow, yes. Yes, sadness. Yes, sadness. It's kind of like the anger-eating demon. I don't know if anybody's heard that story, but there's a story of a king that left his palace and he had his guards protect his throne. And then a little anger-eating demon snuck in and started sitting on the throne. And the guards were like, get the fuck out of here, demon. And this demon just eats it up and just grows. And they're like, you're gross, you're smelly, get out of here. And it just grows and grows and grows. And so with every anger and hateful phrase, the demon grew and grew and grew. And then the king came back and was like, oh, hello, anger-eating demon. So nice of you to come visit. And then it shrunk a little bit. He says, yes, yes, thanks for being here. How about something to drink or a foot rub or a massage? And just how nice can you be to this demon until it gets to a smaller place that you can just set it aside? So if we fight our inner demons with hatred and anger, they're just going to puff up. But if we meet them with a certain amount of care, they become manageable. Vinny Ferraro, let me say that, June 26th, he will be here. He likes to say that when you admit something into existence, it becomes a part of life. And what the Buddha taught about things that become a part of life, they have a life, and they age and die. And until we admit some of these parts of ourselves to life, they will not be a part of the existence of life. They'll just be in our basements hiding. But as soon as we open up with a sense of vulnerability that there's sadness, and then the sadness will have its life and die. It doesn't mean it won't come back. Of course it will come back. But we just go through this process of admitting it's here and let it live. Yes, you'll have your process, you'll move, you'll shift, you'll change. So we meet that with intimacy and investigation. How well can we know this? Whatever this is, this suffering, this stress, this sadness, this grief, what does it feel like in the body? What's the inclination of the mind? How do we know what the mind reacts with and get to know that? So the certain amount of investigation in this I is the mind, because we tell ourselves false stories about these concepts and ideas, but we don't want to spend too much time on the mind because then it'll take us away. We want to embody this experience, know what the heart is feeling, know what the body's feeling, and know from an impersonal approach what the mind believes sometimes about our suffering. And so when we do this, the end of RAIN comes about kind of naturally, that non-identifying. We get some space from our own suffering. It's not my sadness or my grief. It's not who I am. And it's here. And we develop an impersonal approach towards our suffering. And the second end in this is something I like to emphasize. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't in RAIN, but the nurturing. So we get to know what is this, what is this suffering, what can I know about this suffering, and what does this suffering need? So things like loving kindness. When we're afraid, maybe we need some loving kindness. May I be at ease? May I be well. May I be peaceful. And we bring these well wishes to incline the mind, body, and heart to be be full of ease when we're in the middle of our suffering, that we can be at peace in our conflicts, to meet our conflicts with peace, not waiting till our conflict's gone to be at peace, because then we have this conditional peace. We want to have unconditional peace even when the heart is conflicted. And so this nurturing, compassion for pain, appreciation for joy, balance in the middle of all of this. So I don't really know how much I want to say. Like Andrew, very eloquent, smart guy. He said it. There's suffering. Let's change our relationship to the suffering, and there'll be a good amount of peace with that. So I want to make sure I emphasize this is something you do, not something you hear or talk about, and then hopefully it shows up throughout your day. You commit to this practice. And sometimes it may be difficult to commit to that practice. So are you up for it? And like I said, this isn't trying to take you. Sometimes there's ambitiousness. You come in and my therapist says I have this trauma. I got to fix my trauma. So I'm going to go in the deepest depths of my internal hells to meet my trauma. This is slow. This Dharma is slow. Take it slow. And just as the universe, the truth of the universe is revealed in the breath, the truth of our suffering is revealed in my foot is kind of hurting right now. It's like, whoa, what's my relationship to my foot? If I just go by human instinct, it's to hate it. If I go by wisdom, I can care for it. Oh, it's okay. Yes, foot hurting, totally allowed. So something like that. So I'm going to ask you to bring up a difficulty you've had within past year, week, day, and just get to know it. And have the truth of these four noble truths be revealed through this practical application of rain. Sound solid? So we'll do maybe about 10, 15 minutes of this practice. So find a way to sit that is somewhat comfortable. Upright and alert if you're feeling a little sleepy. But if you're feeling a little uptight, it's okay to chill in this one. Nobody's going to grade you on your posture. This is not another arena for self-judgment. So if it's comfortable for you, allowing your eyes to close. So arriving back into your seat, back into the room, what can be known about this present time experience? Always remembering this breath, this friendly companion, available to us anytime we need it. Breathing in acknowledgement and gratitude towards this breath. Pouring your awareness, breathing into the heart space, the chest. feeling into this vulnerable space, keep protected and guarded. We know we're susceptible to death, to sickness, to harm. Just taking this moment to remove any figurative armor that we hold around the heart, undefending ourselves just for this moment by breathing into this space in the heart. So just taking a moment of honesty with this heart, maybe even asking it, where is this heart conflicted? Where are you conflicted, heart? Where is the difficulty in your life right now that you would like to meet directly? What difficulty does this heart experience? What does this mind experience? What does this body experience? I'm just picking this one difficulty and letting it be good enough. Checking in if the mind is replaying stories over and over, or plotting revenge, or I should have done this, I wish this would have happened instead. And just pouring the mind into the body, what's the felt experience of opening up to this difficulty in your life? Body knows so much. What does the body know right now? Maybe even recognizing by naming it. Sadness, stress, grief. You can put a word to it. What would that word be? Recognizing, I see you. Seeing through the delusions or coping strategies and methods of avoiding, just recognizing. Letting go of the fight, letting go of the reactivity. Saying yes, yes, yes. Saying yes to whatever arises. Let this moment just flow through, yes. Just allowing, yes, yes, yes. recognizing what needs to be recognized, what part of you needs to be seen right now, and just surrendering the fight. What part of you has been hiding, just welcoming it with a gentle yes. Becoming curious, how is this process manifesting? It's investigating. What does saying yes to your suffering feel like? How does it show up in the body? How does it show up in the heart and the mind? This intimacy with this part of yourself that may have been hiding. Loving the fullness of ourselves, not just the parts we like. Recognizing and allowing and becoming intimate. Always remembering the breath as the companion along this trip. Recognizing, allowing, becoming intimate, and seeing if there's any space, this non-identifying. Is there any free-flowing movement? This is not mine. This doesn't belong to me. A lack of control, letting go. Let it in, let it be there, let it go. Not a pushing out. If it's still here, great. Yes, I care about you. Not grasping, not pushing away. What does this need? What do you need to hear right now? I care about you. I forgive you. I love you. Thank you. I appreciate you. I'm here for you. Picking some phrases and saying it to this piece of suffering that you're experiencing, that you recognize and allow and become intimate with, what does it need? Nurturing it. It may feel strange to say some caring things to yourself, but we're inclining ourselves to meet ourselves with care. So let it be as it is, saying the things you need to hear, being honest. What do you need to hear right now? Saying it silently towards yourself.